The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. We're back with hour two of On the Fringe with me, Trish Wood. And our first guest for the original hour, the first hour, was John Carpe. And we talked a lot about the Emergencies Act hearings that have been going on in Ottawa, the way they've been covered. It's so very disheartening. I really am losing faith because if the media are not going to be fair brokers for us and the bulwark between us and crooked politicians, we are well and truly sunk. And I cannot, you know, I'm a journalist, right? I've been a journalist my whole life, and I was a very, very good one. I was an investigative journalist on a show out of Canada called The Fifth Estate. I was there for 10 years. And, you know, we took on some really big, big stories. I got an innocent man out of jail. He'd been falsely accused and convicted. He did 5-6 years in prison, maybe longer, and got a big settlement from the government. We took on the false stories of recovered memory and satanic ritual abuse. And all. We did a lot of big stuff. They spent the money, we did the work, and we didn't care who the story affected from a political perspective, right? When I did the satanic ritual abuse false memory story, my feminist sisters wrote bad things about me because it was going against their narrative. So now we live at a time when there are fewer and fewer and fewer people doing what I used to do for a living. We have all of these, you know, the rise of the so-called digital reporter. They're usually people with very little training who don't leave the office. You know, they report through their laptop, so they're not actually seeing things. And I don't know if you know this or not, but I'll say it because it's really important. And once I say it, you won't be able to unsee it because it makes sense. They now teach young journalists in journalism school to see the world through a social justice lens, which on the surface sounds really great. Oh, good, they're sticking up for poor people. But you know what? It's not that simple. What that means is that somebody is going to have to be the decider of what fits into the social justice lens. And as we're seeing now, that frequently involves activist groups telling news media and government how they're supposed to handle certain situations. And that's what obviously we've gone off the rails on some of the extreme trans things and the so-called affirmative care decisions that have happened both in Canada and the United States. That's because they're not just doing straight reporting now. They're listening to the spokespeople for these groups and saying, well, what should I think about this? How do I feel about this? And that's what they're doing. And we're going to talk to Megan Murphy, my second hour guest, in a minute about that very thing. And she actually, I think she's just been reinstated at Twitter after writing things about the trans extremist movement that if you saw the people at Twitter who are responsible for being the arbiters of what gets printed or not on Twitter, I mean, it makes your head spin, right? These are not, I won't say it, but it was pretty sad. Anyway, so she's back on Twitter and we're going to talk to her about that. But I just want to read you something that really highlights what I'm saying about activist groups dictating to media how they cover things. So this is from quite a good writer. She's writing for Barry Weiss, who I love. And her name is Nellie Bowles. And this is what she writes about the Colorado Springs shooting, which was terrible. Obviously, it was an awful event, but it exposed something pretty ugly. The narrative is messy in Colorado Springs. There were three mass shootings this week, a dark entry into the holiday season. One has dominated the headlines. In Colorado Springs, a white man went into a gay bar with a gun and killed 5 people last Saturday. That would be, I think, a week ago today. Colorado Springs is a major hub of evangelical Christianity. You can imagine how the story's been covered. It was clear-cut homophobia. It was Club Q and the demonization of drag queens. It was the fault of conservatives like Chris Rufo or TERFs or comedians. Cable news spun into action. My Instagram filled with friends announcing they stand with their gay friends. The term stochastic terrorism, demonization of a group that leads to violence against them, started getting used to describe anyone who'd ever taken a skeptical stance regarding subjects like youth transitions. And here is the, she points out, the Southern Poverty Law Center, who have completely disgraced themselves in the last few years running with that story. That story, however, had one annoying snag. The suspect, Anderson Lee Aldrich, is not a man at all, according to filings from Aldrich's public defenders. The suspected mass killer goes by they, them pronouns and uses the honorific MX. I guess it's pronounced mix. Who knows? Could could Mix Anderson Lee Aldrich be pretending to identify as non-binary, as a troll, or to be a jerk? Definitely. But there's no official non-binary badge given out by the Bureau. Reporters who talked about this as a right-wing hate crime pivoted on a dime. Mr. Aldrich is the victim, harassed by online edgelords, according to NBC. I mean, really, it's just, you know, you could watch their heads exploding on the news, especially there was one Allison, I think her name's Allison Camerata on CNN. I mean, she just couldn't take in the fact that this guy might be non-binary and not some right-wing white MAGA guy. It's just craziness. So anyway, let's get to Megan. I'm desperate to hear her take on this. Hi, Megan. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. So great to talk to you today.
Nice to talk to you too. So were you following that story with great interest?
Can you remind me? Sorry, I've just been on and off over here.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So I was just replaying for our listeners what happened about the Q Club shooting and the way that the media had to pivot when they found out he was non-binary. It's just so exemplary of how corrupt the media is right now on these issues.
I know. It's hilarious because they're so desperate to create a narrative that they don't do their jobs. You know this as well as anyone. The media in Canada, the media in America does this. We call them the liberal media, but they certainly aren't very liberal. So I don't know what to call them. The mainstream media, I suppose, is more apt.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're so desperate to paint this narrative that they don't do any work and they're being embarrassed constantly. And yet they don't seem to want to acknowledge that. They won't ever, you know, say, oh, sorry, we were wrong. Maybe we shouldn't do this in the future.
No, I know, right? They're shameless. I mean, it's insane.
No, they're completely lacking in accountability. I mean, we saw that through all of the COVID pandemic stuff, right? Where they would report one thing and then all of a sudden the facts would change and they'd report the opposite and there would be no acknowledgement that they'd made a so-called mistake or that they'd lied or that they simply hadn't done their research at all. They were just sort of, you know, towing the party line, really.
Well, what's interesting is they use the word clarification now. They don't say, I'm making a correction. They say, I'm making a clarification, as if what they'd said before was not actually totally wrong. And what's interesting about the mistakes they make is that they're wrong in ways that they shouldn't be wrong. In other words, there's ways to check if stuff is true, you know? And the wrongness tends to come when they have decided to take dictation either from the government or one of the alphabet agencies in DC or an interest group, right? They don't challenge things that fit their own, I'll use the word as you did, liberal narrative, right? They just accept it as true until someone says it's not. Then they go, oops, sort of.
It's really appalling because the role of journalists and the media is supposed to be to, you know, challenge these institutions, to challenge the government narratives, to challenge people in power. And instead they're doing the opposite. And I don't know how they live with themselves, to be honest.
I don't either. It's a very strange thing. And it has created, you know, it has created sort of two tribes for me. And I know you're doing this great thing with Julie Bindle, which we'll talk about in a minute, because I love Julie, but I don't agree with her position on that you're having this sort of interesting debate with her about. But if it makes me the hard-headedness of the journalists who are so invested in narrative scares me into thinking that there won't be a way that we can ever come back together as a culture. or a society. And I was just saying to John Carpe in the first hour, you didn't hear this, but you know, everybody's talking about how great independent media is, especially in Canada. We're getting a lot of really good independent media, but much of it is conservative, right? So the legacy media is left. The conservative media, the independent media coming up is conservative, and there doesn't seem to be anything else yet. You know, there's a few places, maybe Joe Rogan is kind of that, sort of, but it's not good to have two different streams of truth.
No, I mean, and especially not when one version of the truth is ideological. I mean, what's so interesting, I mean, it's maddening, but it's also very revealing, is that these are the no debate people, right? They won't debate with people who disagree with them, who have a different, who are offering a different version of facts or the truth. They won't defend their arguments. They won't defend their positions, which of course reveals to me very obviously that they can't. You know, I think about all the times that people have tried to organize debates between myself and a trans activist, or, you know, somebody who supports gender identity ideology, somebody who supports these ideas that, you know, men should be accepted as women and allowed into women's spaces and things like that. And, you know, almost no one will do it. There was one debate that happened at Mount Royal University in Calgary, at least a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, with myself and a trans activist named Julie Ray Goldstein. But beyond that, everyone else has refused. And to me, I just think, you know, like, if my position is so bad and, you know, I am so wrong, wouldn't these people relish in the opportunity to make me look stupid, to have the opportunity to, you know, shoot down all my arguments and prove how wrong and bad I am? But they won't do it. And to me, I'm not complimenting myself. I'm speaking in any circumstance, because this is how these people behave in all circumstances when they're trying to push their mantras without you know, making good arguments to support them, or without providing evidence to support them, that they can't. They know they can't debate, so they have to bully. And that's why they censor too. You know, they censor, they silence, they bully, they manipulate. They scare people, they ban people from the internet so that they don't have to defend their positions. I find it pretty scary.
Well, it is sort of scary. And I'll tell you where I've seen it before, you know, sort of in my history. And that is when I was reporting on satanic ritual abuse and recovered memory and multiple personality disorder, which is all connected in ways I don't need to go into, but they were all kind of endorsed and nurtured by a certain branch of mostly feminist, but not always, academia, right? And they also in adversarial situations could not and would not hold their own. And it was almost like, you know, the scene in The Exorcist where the priest throws the holy water on Megan, not you, mm-hmm. Megan, but, and she goes, it burns. It's like they, part of their brain understands that from a rational perspective, they will lose, right? And so they're very, very emotional in the way that they respond. And you know where we saw that really, I thought very kind of eloquently shown, was in the Matt Walsh, What is a Woman? Obviously he was glib and there's stuff I didn't love that he did, but the great moments in that film are when he actually confronts the so-called experts and asks them basic questions of fact. And the response is not to engage, but rather to please leave, or you're insulting me, or this feels like violence, or I'm not doing this, right? They couldn't engage with him in a factual way. And that way of responding feels very, very much like what happened when the satanic panic, as it came to be known, was sweeping in the 80s, sweeping through various communities.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Matt Walsh's documentary was really good in that sense, is that he really did manage to reveal how empty these people's arguments and mantras really are. And when he would ask them very, very basic, simple questions, you know, and he wasn't even being confrontational, you know, he was asking really simple, basic questions. And they would get so angry and, you know, just shut down the interview. This is over. We're done. They would accuse him of transphobia. And we've seen that happen in government, too. You know, when people are questioned about their claims that men can have babies and things like that, politicians will say, this line of questioning is transphobic and I refuse to respond. And it's like, how did we get to this point where you think you're a politician, you're making statements that are impacting and shaping legislation and are impacting real lives, real people's lives in tangible ways, in this case, mostly the lives of women and girls. And you refuse to defend your ridiculous statements, your nonsensical, crazy statements, and you're irate that anyone would ask you to defend them? Like, the nerve.
Yeah. No, I know. It's shocking. I want to talk about your little journey through Twitter and where you are now. But because I only really got hooked into this story, I would say, in the last couple of years, because I was always off doing documentaries or whatever. I wasn't really plugged into what was happening in the culture. And one day I woke up and this trans thing was happening everywhere. And I thought, what the hell is going on here? Mm-hmm. And you have been living it for a very long time and very bravely too, I might add. So I just want to, when we come back from break, take you back to the beginning about when and how you started to realize that this thing was happening. And also, you know, I've talked to the woman who writes The 11th Hour, Jennifer Bielek. I've talked to her about how quickly this happened, and I'd really like to get your ideas on that too. So we will be back with more from Megan Murphy, the great Megan Murphy, in a moment.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Kyrie Irving was suspended by the Brooklyn Nets of the NBA after he did not apologize. He shared a clip on his social media from a film called Hebrews to Negroes, Wake Up Black America. Contains numerous anti-Semitic tropes. Irving apologized, quote unquote, after he was suspended without pay for 5 games. But this is the 5th game. And by the way, the 5th game is tonight. He's not playing. And guess what? The Nets have won 3 out of 4 without Kyrie Irving. But it's heating up again for various reasons. And I've never seen high-profile people coalesce around a man who committed a despicable anti-Semitic act. But that's what's happening. Los Angeles Lakers superstar, or whatever you want to call him, LeBron James, says that he believes Kyrie Irving's suspension should end immediately and he should be allowed to play. He tweeted, "I told you guys I don't believe in sharing hurtful information and I'll continue to be that way, but Kyrie apologized and he should be able to play. That's what I think. It's that simple. Help him learn, but he should be playing. What he's asked to do to get back on the floor, I think, is excessive, in my humble opinion. He's not the person that's being portrayed of him. Anyways, back to my rehab session." Oh, okay, great.
Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
In times of fear, World Vision has been there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've stood with kids and families during some of the world's hardest times. Through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and support, helping rebuild lives, and empowering entire communities to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're doing the same today. Because rising to these challenges is in our DNA. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, at home and abroad, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
Without CO2, the world stops. stops breathing. CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Trish Wood here with Megan Murphy, who has been a campaigner for sensibility around the some of the extreme trans issues for a very long time, way before the rest of us cottoned on to the trouble. So, Megan, I want to ask you, when did you first, I guess, become enlightened, maybe is the best way to put it on this, that you realized that it was more than just a kind of a basic civil rights issue for people who felt they weren't being heard?
So the way that I started, actively opposing gender identity ideology was through my work in feminism. In around, I think, 2012, I was doing a feminist radio show out of Vancouver Co-op Radio. We had a website and I was blogging on that website. I was also, in the midst of completing a degree in women's studies. And I was, I was doing a lot of work with Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. And, these are women who have been active, not just in the women's movement, but, they ran a transition house for women who were escaping really the most horrific violence, recovering from really serious abuse, rape, things like that. And, when a woman's going to a shelter or a transition house, it's because she has nowhere else to go and she doesn't have the means to go anywhere else. That would be a last resort. They're very marginalized women, often women who've been really traumatized. And Vancouver Rape Relief had been, I think in around 1999, taken through a human rights tribunal process by a man named Kimberly Nixon. And Kimberly Nixon had, he identified as a trans woman, or perhaps just a woman. I think that it was more popular at that time to identify as a trans woman versus a woman, but same. He showed up at their training session for counselors, where women were being trained in how to answer the call lines, when women were calling in to get support after having been raped or assaulted. And the women running the training session told him, "I'm sorry, we only accept women counselors. There's only women who are part of the Vancouver Rape Relief Collective. There's only women in the transition house. There's only women who answer the call lines. So I'm sorry, you can't be trained to be a counselor." And this guy, because he cares so much about the well-being of women, took them to court.
Yeah.
Well. And tried to sue them. And they lost on the provincial level, but they took it all the way to the federal level and they won. And they won on the basis that not that they had the right to exclude men from the shelter, but on the basis that they had the right to determine their own membership. But ever since that, they've been tarred as transphobic and harassed and harassed and harassed endlessly by activists in Vancouver.
Wow.
Working to destroy them, working to have their funding pulled. Again, this is like, there's so few places like this in Canada and in the world. They struggle to survive. They struggle to raise their funds to keep the house going. They have tons and tons of women who volunteer, who work for free just to help women, who are again, so marginalized, so traumatized with nowhere else to go. And this is what these activists do with their time, is try to destroy a transition house and shelter and rape crisis line for women because it's for women only. And I was so angry about this, obviously I'm still angry about this. And so I just, I was always defending Rape Relief and I wanted to be able to defend them well. I wanted to be able to explain why it was important to have women-only spaces. I wanted to understand Rape Relief's position on women-only spaces. And that's how I got into this fight in defense of women. And as soon as you do that, of course, you're tarred as transphobic as well. And yeah, I mean, it was so wrong to me and I couldn't not say anything. And I don't really understand when other people can't say anything. You know, I know it's scary because I've done it myself. It's incredibly scary. And I was punished and have been punished immensely ever since then. You know, I've been kept out of mainstream media as best they could manage and blackballed in all left-wing spaces, blackballed by most feminists. But it's so wrong. And I can't lie. That's what I don't understand about these people.
Yeah.
Is so, you know, so many people who defend the trans activist position and who defend gender identity ideology, I don't believe that they all actually literally believe that a man can become a female. Maybe some do, but all, none of these politicians do. They're just lying. They're lying because they don't want to have to deal with the controversy or the challenges of saying, no, men can't become women. And I think that's appalling.
You know, it's really interesting that you said that, because when I was watching Allison Camerota's head explode on the Colorado story, she had on a trans woman who was going to be her expert witness against the fact now that this chap who is accused of doing the shooting is claiming binary status, right? They want to take that away from him. So she's interviewing this man with a long blonde wig on, who's obviously a man. And the man in the long blonde wig is saying, well, I can tell that that person's non-binary because you can see just by looking at him that he's a man. And I thought, like, I am, right? I felt like I am it. And so for Allison Camerota to sit there and not get what she's just actually exposed, the opposite of what she was trying to show, you know, it's like ridiculous. But let me just say this, because you said something really, really important. And it is a kernel of, I think, maybe what drives you and certainly what gets me fired up too. And that is the idea that for these trans activists to target a rape crisis center is the absolute epitome of misogyny, right? It's hatred. It's hatred. Like, why? Like, if they didn't hate women, they would just move along and let that bunch of people do what they're doing. But they have to destroy women in the argument that they are making. And that's what became obvious to me in the last, I would say the last year and a half or so, that there's an element of woman hating here that is terrifying to me. And that's actually where you and Julie Bindel share a lot, right? That's, she has the same position.
Right. And if you watch how, and if you know how trans activists operate, and, you know, as I said, I've witnessed this in Vancouver. I mean, I've witnessed it all over the place, but I witnessed it very closely, kind of firsthand in Vancouver with regard to the treatment of Vancouver rape relief. And then, of course, in terms of how I've been treated by trans activists, it's completely misogynist and it's so hateful. It's like, why would you go after women in this way? These women are not affecting your life. These women are not after you. No one is trying to shut down your spaces. No one is trying to shut down your activism. You know, I'm not showing up. Vancouver Rape Relief is not showing up at a meeting of trans activists. Or, you know, if Vancouver Rape Relief has said many times over the years, you know, like, if these people want to set up a transition house, a shelter, some kind of crisis line, any kind of space to support trans identified people, they've said, you know, we'll help you, we'll support you. I wouldn't say that. I don't support trans activism, but I certainly wouldn't go out of my way to stop it from happening.
Right, right.
But
right,
exactly. What they're trying to do is they're trying to destroy this place for helping women, you know, and they've done things over the years, like they've graffitied their storefront. They've left dead animals in their mailbox, active death threats all the time. You know, I've been threatened with death. I've been stalked around Vancouver. I've been threatened with violence many, many times. Just endless, you know, we were the ones who were under attack, and these people have managed to frame themselves as somehow marginalized, despite the fact that all of mainstream media and politics and academia, you know, all of these institutions support trans activism, and trans activists unequivocally refuse to challenge trans identified people and support the, you know, destruction and silencing of women. You know, will fire women who challenge them, who will refuse to challenge death threats, will refuse to say, you know, you're behaving in a threatening, violent, misogynist way because it's somebody who identifies as a trans woman.
And you know what? What this has exposed in the culture too is how easily and how quickly women can be kind of thrown back under the bus again, right? Like the fact that women who are like you and others who are correctly protesting this behavior can be threatened in this way and nobody does anything. I mean, I'm still reading stories in the UK about there was a woman who was arrested. The police came to her house because she misgendered somebody on Twitter, maybe. I mean, if I'm wrong, I'm close to being right. It's a story like that. Like, how did it happen? How did it happen that the only people who matter now are trans activists who complain about women? I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, they came to her house. I think her kids were there and stuff. It was really, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the first time that kind of thing has happened. And I mean, again, I think it's so funny how these people want to claim marginalized status and yet they have so much power. And that's how this happened, is that there are powerful men with a lot of money who are in positions of power, who are bullies, who are narcissists, who have been able, you know, either to fund trans activists, you know, activism or organizations. And in terms of the big tech thing, I mean, what we've discovered, which, you know, many of us sort of knew, but now it's all come out into the open. So it's very interesting, is that behind the scenes at Twitter, for example, there were these, you know, these men who identify as women, who are manipulating things behind the scenes and, you know, banning women like me, banning anyone who challenges, banning from Twitter, who challenges transgender ideology. And, you know, they seem to have power in all of these institutions, again, academia, in politics, and people are scared of them. People are afraid to stand up, and it just, it runs so deep. You know, they have the power to determine the truth and who's allowed to access the internet and speak and they have money, and yet they've framed it in the complete opposite way, as though they're persecuted minority. And it's simply not true. They're just men. I hate this. You know, there's a lot of people who call themselves gender critical, who are challenging, you know, gender identity ideology in public, which is a good thing. And you know, I support those people, but there's no such thing as transgender. There's no such thing as a trans person. The entire ideology is a lie. You can't change sex. There's nothing special about these people, except that perhaps some of them are mentally ill. And a lot of them, the men in any case, have sexual fetishes. You know, they have a cross-dressing fetish, autogynephilia. That's the situation with, you know, most, if not all of the adult men who transition. But you know, there's a large contingent of people who tiptoed into this arena, to challenge what's going on, but who will still insist, you know, well, you know, these trans people, you know, we do need to protect trans people, or, you know, they're using correct so-called pronouns. You know, they're referring to men as she, referring to men as she, referring to women as he, or going along with this they them nonsense. And I think it perpetuates the problem, especially when we're talking about journalism, because we're seeing news reports where violent men, where rapists, where men who have molested children, men who have murdered people, men who've murdered women, it's being reported on as a woman, as she.
Yeah. No, I, and interestingly, the Daily Mail is one of the papers that does that a lot. They are absolutely in the tank and writing. I think I might have talked about this on the show before, but they wrote a headline once about someone who was non-binary or claimed non-binary. And so they were using the they, them pronoun in the headline. And but also in the headline were a married couple, right? So the they, them made you not understand that they were actually talking about this single non-binary. Anyway, the headline was completely, it was nonsensical. It was ridiculous. And so my question as an old school journalist is, how are these things getting past the editors at the desk at the Daily Mail? I mean, the Daily Mail is notorious for, you know, typos and repeated paragraphs and stuff like that. But I mean, they must have an editor's desk. And I'm surprised that being clear about what you're saying can't have primacy over somebody's sexual fetish. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, I don't know for sure, cause I'm not working in these places, but I think on some level people maybe think it doesn't matter. You know, yeah. I've talked to people and questioned people about why they refer to a man as she, and they're like, well, you know, I'm just trying to be nice. I don't need to be mean. And, you know, I don't consider the truth to be mean. I don't consider it mean to refer to a man as he, just because, you know, he doesn't like it. You know, it's not an opinion. Calling a man he isn't an opinion. That's just how you refer to a male. And yeah, I think that they maybe don't see the larger picture, but also what it really is again, they don't want to have to deal with that controversy. You know, it's people pleasing. It's trying to protect themselves. They're trying to protect their jobs. They're trying to, you know, get along rather than push back, which I don't respect.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk to you a little bit more about language because it's so very, very important. So we will be back in a moment with Megan Murphy.
Give me a minute. With TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. I myself am thankful for my family, my health, and the show I do here on TNT Radio. But I also must say I'm very thankful that we're finally rid of the quote-unquote leadership of one Nancy Pelosi in Congress. The can-do-no-wrong darling of the left-wing media announced last week that she would no longer seek a leadership position and was immediately declared the most wonderful person ever to walk the halls of Congress by a sycophant media. Well, when I think of Nancy Pelosi, I think of the disrespect she showed for President Trump and our nation when she ripped up his State of the Union script following the address in 2020. And back in July of 2020, after a mob tore down a statue of Christopher Columbus and threw it in the harbor in her native city of Baltimore, she shrugged.
I don't care that much about statues.
Respectfully, shouldn't that be done by a commission or the city council, not a mob in the middle of the night throwing it into the harbor?
People will do what they do.
People will do what they do? That's anarchy. That's Nancy Pelosi. We should all be thankful she's decided to fade away. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg bought the 2020 election with hundreds of millions of dollars in funding that likely handed the White House to Joe Biden last year, according to a new analysis. Researcher William Doyle of the Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CRERI, said election funding funneled by Zuckerberg and his wife through two nonprofits significantly increased Joe Biden's vote margin in key swing states. The Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, passed a staggering $419.5 million of Zuckerberg's money into local government elections offices. The research found the massive influx of funds essentially created a high-powered concierge-like get-out-the-vote effort for Biden that took place inside the election system. Rather than attempting to influence it from the outside, appears to have generated enough additional votes for Biden to secure Electoral College victory in 2020.
Every public classroom should have a camera where parents can watch and listen during class. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Trish Wood here, and we are on the fringe with some conversation with Megan Murphy about what seems to have happened very, very quickly. I talk about it quite a bit on the show these days because I'm feeling sort of threatened by it. I'm not young. I didn't think I'd see the day that women, after all the things we fought for and won, would be, you know, on the boot heel again. And we seem to be that. I mean, I find it very disheartening, and I worry about young women because I don't think they see it and I don't think they get it. They're kind of captivated by what's happening right now. But Megan Murphy isn't. She gets it. And she's someone I admire very much because she's fought very, very hard on behalf of women in the face of this onslaught of insanity. And I will say, Megan, I think there is an element of craziness to this because, you know, as we talked about with Matt Walsh, the people who are really pushing it can't even defend it on a logic. It's an emotional thing. It's almost like a religion or something. You know, it's really stopped making sense, which is why it becomes so scary when, you know, when we have something like this shooting in Colorado and they instantly make the motive for the shooting to be violence against gay and trans people when that might not have been the case at all. I know that with the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida, they did that. I mean, Anderson Cooper flew down and he was, you know, weeping and waving a rainbow flag and stuff. And it turned out that the person who pulled the trigger, I believe, was gay, but that the motivation was anger. He was a Muslim and he was angry about the Iraq war. Who isn't? And that's what it was actually about. So it's sort of like truth doesn't matter. We're just going to keep pushing these ideas and lots of people benefit from it, not women particularly, and on it rolls. It's really very, very disheartening to me.
Yeah, I mean, they want the narrative to be true so badly because it suits their political interests. And so it just means, as we talked about earlier, it's just embarrassment after embarrassment when they make these assumptions rather than doing any work to look into what was behind the situation. You know, Jussie Smollett is an obvious example that, you know, the whole of media and, you know, all of the wokes online instantly went along with, you know, this is a hate crime, you know, racism in America, it's so scary. All these Trumpists are, you know, after minorities, violence is happening in the streets. And it just turned out to be probably mentally ill. I mean, I think that's a pretty mentally ill kind of thing to do.
I would think so.
Narcissist, attention seeking. And nobody bothered to question it or look into it because they wanted so badly for it to be true. You know, what they want is to be able to vilify people who aren't like them. You know, the media did that the entire time that Trump was in power. And of course, before the election. You know, to treat all people who voted for Trump as dangerous Nazis, white supremacists, misogynists, transphobes, so on and so forth. And they don't care to understand. And it's really unfortunate because that's creating hate. You know, it's not the people who voted for Trump. I mean, I'm sure there are people who support Trump who are hateful. But in large part, people voted for Trump because they hated the Democrats. They hated Hillary Clinton. They didn't trust Hillary Clinton. They didn't trust the Democrats. They wanted something different. They felt ignored. They felt marginalized, and they were being marginalized. They were being marginalized and ignored by those in power, by politicians, by the media, and insulted. Over and over and over again. Why would you vote for a party that insults you? Why would you support the activism of people who insult you and treat you as stupid? You know, too stupid to make choices about who to vote for. You know, these are often these are working class people who are struggling to survive. and being told that they're, you know, fascists and racists and irrelevant, you know, not worth speaking to, not worth hearing from, not worth understanding. You know, these people are creating hate and division in America, and something similar has happened in Canada. You know, we saw that happen with Trudeau and his treatment of the truckers and everyone who supported the truckers across Canada and the people who were fighting for their rights. These are our rights. These are our charter rights. You know, fighting against a government that is abusing its power, which is what everybody should do. You know, if we lose our rights, we lose everything. And Trudeau turned around and spread lies and hate and made the situation much worse. And a lot of people, you know, progressives, the elites in Canada supported him.
Yeah, no, 1,000%. We were just talking a little bit about this with John Carpe and the Prime Minister's appearance yesterday at the hearings, where he flat out denied that he'd actually said the things he'd said. I mean, it was very, very disheartening for me, because, you know, he kind of got away with it. And I was sitting there watching the lawyer who was questioning him. You know, she wasn't prepared. I think, as I said to John in the first hour, I think people are maybe not expecting the Prime Minister to out and out lie. So you're not prepared for it when you're doing kind of an interrogation of him, right? And it's like when I was at the Fifth Estate, I would prep and prep and prep to be able to expose things in interviews with people like Trudeau, who are kind of are slippery and not at all ashamed about being dishonest. And it takes a certain kind of preparation, because you want to be able to create a moment where you're showing truth, right? And I felt like I was very disappointed in the way, you know, he did say under oath that he didn't call unvaccinated people names. That is an absolute lie. We heard it. It's on tape, some of it in French, but, you know, it's there. And so he'll maybe pay for that down the road at some point. But it was very, very disheartening to watch him kind of slither out of what happened here. Because like you say, these were good people. None of the charges that were brought against them, mostly by the media and by the politicians in Ottawa City Council and the feds, none of them turned out to be true, right? The arson was not true. The Proud Boys funding through GoFundMe was also a lie. You know, I mean, all of it was just garbage. And so clearly one cannot defend the imposition of the Emergencies Act, nor the freezing of bank accounts, but he might skate on it, you know, because the media is not there doing their job. They should be surrounding him as he walked out of the building and saying, "Why did you lie about that? Here we have you on tape saying it," but they won't do that because they like him. So that is how democracy ends. Not to be too dramatic about it, but that's how it ends when the media side with, I think it's a corrupt government, obviously, if they're lying. When the media side with that, it's a problem. But let's just, I want to get you on Julie Bindle. So quickly, so the issue as I understand it is, and I think I saw Julie Bindle is an old school feminist. She's an amazing campaigner for women against the onslaught of gender ideology, but she is much less welcoming, I believe, of people, conservative men, I guess, to the party. Is that the gist of what the argument is, or the debate?
Yeah, I mean, this debate has always confounded me a bit. And I want to say, I mean, I think Julie is incredible. She's done so much incredible work in her career for women. She's an amazing journalist. I love her as a person. She's my friend. I've known her for many years now. I've worked with her. I've done panels with her. She's great. This debate around, it's framed as, should feminists ally with the right. And one of my problems with the debate is that I can never figure out what they mean by ally with the right. You know, to me, I'm in a particular situation, I suppose, because I'm a writer and I have two podcasts. So I spend a lot of my time talking to people and interviewing people. And I'm not interested in just interviewing people who are going to say things that I already know. You know, part of what you get out of talking to people and interviewing people, as you know, is you learn something new, you learn a different perspective. You know, you're talking to people who are experts in areas that you're not, perhaps. But I want to talk to all sorts of people. I want to understand people and the world around me as best I can. So I'm certainly not going to limit my conversations to only people who see things my way. I, of course, don't see things in the same way as I used to. You know, for most of my life, I identified as a feminist and a leftist, which I no longer do. Which is not to say that I'm not a feminist. I don't want to label myself because I find it very limiting. And these labels seem to have totally lost meaning. But I certainly am not going to identify as leftist because I think what the left has become is so at odds with, you know, my ethics and my views and what I think would build a just world. But I think I guess these feminists don't want to. They do think that right wing people are bad. They think that they're dangerous. And as best I can tell, it's based on stereotypes. You know, it's the same. It's like, well,
and
right-wing
propaganda.
People support, right-wing people support racism. Right-wing people are misogynist. They want to put women back in the kitchen. They don't respect women. And to me, it's like very clear that the left doesn't respect women at all. The left has spent the past, you know, I mean, I've always challenged the left in my feminism because the left has been, they've been the ones to come after me, whether it's because I'm, you know, in opposition to the legalization of prostitution, because I think pornography is bad for women and for society. And now, of course, on account of my position on gender identity ideology and women's sex-based rights, that, you know... Again, I don't want to say like all right-wing people are so great, but the horrific, endless hate and harassment and the efforts to libel me and silence me have all come from the left.
Yeah.
Always. You know, and the things that they're willing to say to me are abhorrent and appalling. You know, they're misogynists.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you can say, you know, and I know a lot now. I never used to know any conservative people or right-wing people, but now I do. And those people that I know have been, you know, the right has been far more respectful towards me. And they don't hate women. I wouldn't engage with people who hated women. So the people, if there's people on the right who don't like, you know, there are right-wing people who I think are incredibly sexist. Matt Walsh is one of those people. I genuinely think he doesn't respect women.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I'm going to take people as they are. So I'm going to treat people as the individuals that they are. So if I'm talking to a right-wing person who's a Christian conservative, whatever, and this person has integrity, is respectful, is interesting, who I think is a good person, I'm not going to shun them because they voted for someone differently than me or because they believe in something that I don't, because they're religious and I'm not. If they are sexist, if they are racist, if they are hateful, if you know, it's more likely that I would shun somebody because they lacked an integrity, because they were a liar.
Yeah.
Because they were shady.
Well, I think you're like me.
I thought they were abusive.
Sorry, abusive, yeah. So I mean, I think you're like me in the sense that, like, I am now politically homeless, right? So, you know, kind of libertarian after COVID for a bunch of reasons I won't bore you with. But also, you know, I have my affection is for the working class always and for the underdog always. But I actually think I agree with you on the Julie Bindle take, as much as I also love her. I don't think we can reject, you know, one of the highlights of me of all of the COVID coverage was when Tucker Carlson had Naomi Wolf on, right? And I thought, yay, like, this is great. You know, it's wonderful that they are They don't agree with a lot of stuff, but they agree. And also he has Kara Danski on frequently too, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, so if a guy with 5 million viewers wants to be an ally against gender ideology nuttiness, I'll take it. You know, plus he has 4 dogs that sleep on the bed with him at night. So how can you not?
So he's like obviously a good man.
He's obviously a good man.
Yeah. Sold.
But you know what I'm saying? Like I did see that tweet of Julie's and I, you know, maybe it's her age or maybe, I don't know, maybe things are much different in the UK than they are here and in the States. But, oh, that's our theme music. I got to go. Yikes. Megan Murphy, thank you so much for doing the show. I'm so very grateful. I really am.
Yeah,
I admire
you.
Thank you
for having me.
Yeah, no, I admire you and I want you to keep going. I know it hasn't been easy and you were one of the first people out there speaking up on behalf of women against this onslaught of insanity. So thank you very much. You got
thank
a Substack
so
too, right?
Work.
They can.
Thank right, you yeah. So
much.
Julie and I, our letter exchanges on Substack. My Substack is called The Same Drugs, but it's just, you know, substack.com, Megan Murphy. And you can find my and Julie's conversation around this is still ongoing. And I've been enjoying it a lot. And it seems like it's resonating with other people as well. So that's great. I love Substack.
Great. I love Substack too. Thanks, Megan Murphy. See ya.